Rat.
Rose.
No.
Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome back to Warp Trails. This is the RetroZap Podcast Network show devoted to Star Trek. I'm your host, Dennis Keithley. As with me, as always, is my wife, co-host, compeer, and most favorite Star Trek fan, Beth.
But I notice not your heart's compeer, just compeer in general. Hello, everyone. How are you?
Oh, you just had to try and be more clever than me. Okay.
I did.
You are my
It'll
wife.
It'll be the Come last on. Time this episode.
Yeah. Well, we'll be discussing Whistlespeak, which is the sixth episode of season five of Discovery. It will be a full spoiler discussion. This is a episode that deals with a pre-warp, pre-industrial society. So we've got prime directive matters involved as Captain Michael Burnham and Lieutenant Tilly are looking for the next clue on the planet of... what is the name of that planet? It is the planet of Holomno. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a very clear theme that's about spiritualism versus science, not necessarily science, but belief, I should say, running through two different plot lines in this. And of course, by the end of the episode, they found the next clue and will be on their way. So we'll get to some of the details as we discuss this. But first, Beth, what was your overall thoughts and feelings on this episode?
I like this one. This is a certain kind of Star Trek episode, and I like the way they handled this certain kind of Star Trek episode. I'm on board. I like episodes of Star Trek that, you know, to the point about being clever, this is a certain kind of Star Trek episode, and it hit all the notes, but the way they went about it did a really good job setting up so that the viewer knew something was up, but without either Burnham or Tilly looking like an idiot. And I really appreciated that. What did you think?
I liked it, but I felt like there was a point in this episode that Michael and Tilly should have been asking more questions than they did.
100%. 100%. There is a scene where I think Burnham should have asked a lot of questions. I think Ratha should have asked many questions of her father. I do think there was a lot of I know just enough about a lot of societies that this is very much red flagging. But yeah.
Right. And of course, the point I'm talking about is, and I'm assuming you are too, is that this whole notion that we're dealing with a world that is being protected by a weather tower, which is malfunctioning, but the people there don't know that this tower is actually a tower. They think it's a mountain that has a temple carved into it. And it's been left by the Denobulans, one of which was the scientists that were involved in this quest for the progenitors. And they are under the belief that they have to make a sacrifice. Someone goes into this tower and they're sacrificed. And then the gods will provide rain in response to it. Okay. But of course, Michael and Tilly don't pick up on this. And to your point, it was somewhat clever in the way they did it, because they're supposed, they're disguised as the beings that live on this planet, and it's assumed everybody knows that is part of this religion. You have the race to the tower, and then once you get inside, someone gets sacrificed, and then there's rain. But it feels like enough things happen along the way, and they get away with asking, I don't want to say stupid questions, but questions that they wouldn't necessarily normally be able to get away with, that you should have gone the one step further to find out a little bit more about things that were happening.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. But I think we'll dive into it as we get a little further. It is not, and I think one of the reasons why it doesn't super annoy me about Burnham and Tilly is that because Ratha also didn't know the answers, because they weren't asking their father some questions. I mean, I will just tell you, when the head of a religion tells you not to be part of a ceremony, you should ask at least 8 follow-up questions.
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up, because I couldn't tell. So you took it that she didn't know that it was a sacrifice when she was going into the temple. Because I knew Tilly didn't know, and Michael didn't know that was going to happen, but are you reading it that Rava also didn't know that she'd be sacrificing herself?
That's my read. There is a very legitimate read, and if this is how you're reading it, I agree that maybe she changed her mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got, and maybe this is actually a problem of the episode, or maybe this is one of the features of the episode, is that because of the, what was her name? The woman from the beginning who, you know, has the lung, has the dust
the elder,
in her lung.
We just call her the elder.
Yeah, the elder, who says that she misses her friend. Between the fact that the elder didn't really kind of talk about it, and the fact that they'd said it'd been so long since they had done the journey, I was a little unclear about what people knew about what. So, like I said, there's a read where Ratha changes their mind in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a read that I take that her father never really explained what was happening, what would happen, and had been kind of intentionally pulling off, intentionally delaying the journey of the Mother Compeer because of the end of it.
Okay. Yeah. You make a good case for all of that. For me, it was when the elder was explaining how she once had a friend. They both raced in this and the friend won. Now she, you know, and now she often thinks of what it would have been like if her friend was still around, how they'd grown older together and things like that. It's like, I remember you and I were sitting on the couch and we started like perking up at this point. It was while we were watching this that, Michael, Tilly, and, you know, and then when they get to the race itself and they all of a sudden they're given these, I don't know what they are, salt tabs or whatever that makes them dehydrated and very thirsty. And they have to complete this race while thirsty. And they are also kind of they show up, you know, having doubts at the beginning of the race about what's going on. And they aren't clear. It's like, stop and get your questions answered at this point. If you have any doubts, why are we waiting around? So I don't want to call this the idiot ball problem, but it is idiot ball light on here. And that's my biggest objection to this episode right now, is that there should have been additional questions asked. And it might, now I don't know if they still get out of this episode without breaking the prime directive, which is a big deal. But we can get to that when we get to that. Okay. So, you know, they have to go through a bunch of tests to figure out this clue, which includes, okay. So did Kovic intercept Michael when she was beaming out of the science lab, or did she go there on purpose?
I think she went there on purpose. It is very unclear. So this is, again, Beth makes up things to fill up a gap. But it looked like she pulled the infinity ring thing out of, I guess, a pocket because it had vibrated.
I didn't notice that. All right.
So she looks at it in her hand, and I don't know how it called to her. Like I said, I'm assuming in the future all uniforms have pockets because I have to have hope for the future, and that she's just been carrying it around in her pocket.
Okay. See, I completely missed the infinity signet that she pulled out. All right. Well, thanks for pointing that out. So I feel like, okay, so she wasn't intercepted, but I figured this had to be like your favorite moment in the entire episode, being the pen and stationery connoisseur that you are, when he puts down a legal pad of 21st century, a genuine 21st century legal pad that's got the names of all the scientists that were involved in this written on it. And there's two left that we haven't encountered. And he gives that to her as a lead into figuring out this clue, which is just a vial of distilled water, pure distilled water. And then from there, they're able to figure out that it does go to this planet of Halimno, because there, what, you know, one of these scientists is Hitoshi Creel, was a Denobulan, and the Denobulans had set up these weather towers on this planet. And so it made perfect sense to get there. But I'll give you a chance to geek out about stationery.
Well, I mean, I just loved the idea that, you know, having a genuine 21st century legal pads, because, you know, the feel of paper was just the coolest thing ever. I wish we had seen a pen. You know, it was just so, it was like, so like, yeah, you're right. I totally geeked out. I was like, ooh. But then I was also like, how sad that like Burnham comes up and like touches it and like, thinks it's really like, how did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
guys, this is a legal pad. Like, come on.
Yeah.
But no, I did enjoy it very much. And I've always enjoyed that in Star Trek, you know, in the original, Bones always likes paper. He likes the feel of real books. So yes, I always like those callbacks too. I like the feel of paper. So yes, that made me happy.
Yeah. So let's jump to the B plot on this. And that mm-hmm. is something that got started, was it last week, I guess, with Culber, in that he is feeling a sense of attunement, of belonging to something greater, a connectivity that he can't explain. And he says it's rooted in his experience with the Jiantar, which is, of course, that process by which a former Trill host inhabited his body, mm-hmm. which was Janal. And this comes up with a subplot with Booker, you know, wanting to be involved in everything's going on right now. And Culber has to counsel him that you just kind of have to accept that you can't be involved in everything right now. So take advantage of the downtime, to which Booker says, do you ever get tired of voice being right? And he says, no. But that plays into the end of this plot line where, you know, he consults with the holographic representation of his grandmother about, what was it, Mofongo?
Yes,
recipe.
Mofongo.
And
it is a Puerto Rican dish with plantains as its main ingredient.
Sounded delicious. I know you're not a plantain fan, but
it looked really good.
Right.
And I'm sure there's enough garlic that we could, that even I would be willing to eat it.
Right. But apparently his abuela was also a doctor. And, you know, he was using this, hopefully, as a sounding board to try and figure out why it is that he was having this feeling. He was looking for a scientific explanation. And then we can short circuit going through every single one of the scenes, but he talks to Stamets and gets some neurological scans done, looking for some sort of physiological cause of all this, doesn't find any. And then Stamets tells him just to enjoy it. And then he gets to be involved in the revival of Rava and Tilly at the end of the episode. And then he ends up with a final season with a scene rather with Booker where he's talking about this. And it's kind of pointed out to him that, you know, this is, Booker says something I really liked, you know, it's like a human quirk that in order for something to be special, it can't just be felt by an individual. It has to be shared. And, you know, while in fact it, you know, it can be meaningful if it's just personal to oneself.
I really like that. I liked, and that wasn't, I agree with you. It wasn't exactly where Book was going, but I also liked the idea that you can have a partner who is supportive of a thing, doesn't necessarily like or join you in participation in the thing, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because Stamets is never... I mean, Stamets is, you know, is concerned, rightfully so, you know, and at one point he's, you know, you talk about somebody who is asking all the questions. Stamets is asking all the questions. Even at one point he said, it's not a question, but he says, there's something you're not saying.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that discussion. And I don't, Stamets has never said, I don't care. Like, I just liked it. I like how, I think I've always liked how this couple has been represented because at the end of the day, they are a healthy couple that communicates usually relatively well. And I think this is a good, if this is the couple where they make the case that, look, your partner doesn't have to be into any, everything that you are, but as long as they are support, you know, go have fun. That is a healthy relationship. And I think that's kind of, so I liked Book's point that, like, I don't understand why something can't just be yours.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of a bigger picture. Your partner doesn't have to be into or think everything you do as long as they aren't discouraging you on a positive path.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And it also occurred to me, like, this is one of the few times we've actually seen Culber and Stamets together this season.
Mm-hmm.
They've really not had an opportunity to be a couple this season much. But Stamets did get to try and be supportive in the way, best way he could, and he knew how, I thought, which was, mm-hmm. you know, he kept pointing out, I was like, I can't find anything wrong with you, and that's a good thing. So we should be happy about that. And since that's the case, then whatever it is, you should enjoy it, you know? And I thought that was incredibly supportive.
And that's what I mean. Like, Stamets yeah. was was great. I don't quite understand, and I don't know that I care. I don't understand why Colbert believes that somebody who lives out of time wouldn't be open to the spiritual, but I don't know that I particularly care. And I don't even need a time. And in fact, I don't even want a storyline where Colbert is wrong and Stamets is also into the, is also having a spiritual awakening. I am perfectly fine with Colbert having a spiritual awakening that is supported by Stamets, but Stamets never participates.
Yeah.
You go, babe.
Yeah. I'm good with all that. But, you know, of course this is the obvious flip of what's going on planet side, where, yes, you know, down there on planet side, it is faith being challenged by the revelation of science. In this case, you have the doctor who is all about the science and looking for the physiological cause of something, but he is feeling this tug towards the spiritual. So, you know, he ends, I think, being able to accept that, because the flip side of it is when Michael tells Ovaz, the priest down on the planet, mm-hmm, that just because we revealed ourselves and we revealed the science doesn't mean that your gods aren't real. It doesn't mean,
right,
you know, they can coexist. And so, you know, and this is the flip of that. It's just because you believe in the science and we've not been able to show that there is a scientific portion of it, it doesn't mean, again, that, you know, the gods aren't, you know, that your spiritualism is real, that you can't feel these things, and it doesn't diminish your belief in the science.
Right.
So I thought that was one of the better elements of this episode.
For sure. For sure. For sure. I really liked it. And I really liked, that scene at the end, between the father and Burnham with that whole conversation. I really thought Burnham did an excellent job. And one of the things I thought was really interesting is how Burnham's message is a very Burnham message, but I noticed her dialogue was much more to the planet than how she would have, like, if she was standing on the Discovery, she would have never said things that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of like the actual word choice, which I thought was really kind of cool.
Right. I guess there's another subplot. Might as well get this one out of the way too. And this is Adira, and they've had, mm-hmm, an opportunity to be on the bridge. In fact, Rainer is the one that's brought them up on the bridge because Adira had requested the time and Rainer thought that they were ready. And, but, mm-hmm, once they get up there, Adira is facing some challenges. And because when it gets to the tower, they figure out that this one's going to fail, that there were four other towers on the planet, which have all failed and wiped out the civilizations that were around them, or those, mm-hmm, civilizations died off as a result at any rate. And so Adira is working on this, but they are struggling to explain to Captain Burnham what it is that they need to do at the auxiliary control panel to fix everything. And they want to throw in the towel, but Rainer won't let them. And, you know, and Rainer, I think, finally gets through to Adira that the bug that got on board that caused the time loop was not their fault. And I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to think Rainer might have been the only one that could get through. Mainly because he didn't have the personal relationship with Adira that everybody else did.
Agree. No, I completely agree. And any parent who is listening knows, you tell your child something,
mm-hmm,
you know, and in this case, Stamets did last week. Adira, this is not your fault. And Adira listened to Stamets and basically, you know, oh, but you're my foster dad. It's, you know, you're, you know, obligated to whatever. And then you get it from, you know, and then that same child gets it from an outside authority figure. And all of a sudden, oh, now it's real. Now it's believable. And I agree. I think Rainer needed to be like, look, Adira, not get over it, because that's not fair. But Rainer basically does say, like, this isn't your fault and you need to stop thinking it.
Yeah. This episode just confirmed, I think, something we've talked about, at least for me, that Rainer, I think, is my favorite character of this season.
Rainer's great. I really like how he continues. I agree with you. I like how he continues to have a personality where you can see 100% how he would be a captain, but he is not that, but he is also being supportive of, like, he's a good first officer. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. He is a good first officer.
Yeah. And if all the characters, he's had the best story arc. from being the outsider that had his own way of doing everything. And now he's bought in to Michael's methodology on Discovery because it's her ship. He doesn't really have a choice. He's still not the S man that he, and he promised her that he wasn't going to be one when she first recruited him back. What was it? Back at the end of the first episode. And so, or the second, doesn't matter, but he's had this chance to evolve and they have not had him backslide just for the sake of a story point in any one of the episodes. And I can't help but feel like that the shortened season, you know, the previous seasons were all 15 episodes and this one's only getting 10. They don't have as much time to fill and they don't have time for those type of moments in this season.
Right, which seems to be so far coming at the to the benefit of the season.
Mm-hmm. So, what did you think about this decision to break the Prime Directive?
I mean, I enjoy a good Prime Directive breaking episode of Star Trek. So, I might not be the girl to ask because I'm like, on one hand, I mean, if I was living in that world, I would probably be a little more like, how dare you? On the other hand, I have never not watched the Prime Directive not get broken for the sake of a captain wanting to do something. And frankly, my understanding is that Tilly is going to be in another Star Trek series, you know, focused on the Academy. So there was no way she was going to die. So either they were going to be able to successfully beam her out or they were going to break the Prime Directive. You know, so I guess in the interest of the, in the time available to Burnham, I think Burnham did what needed to be done because it didn't feel like she tried to get the bridge to, you know, beam people out, tried to get her beamed into that room that all the air was being sucked out of. And it seemed like not an option. So I guess my take is I'm fine with it because I feel like Burnham tried not to break the Prime Directive and decided not to let people die in order to preserve the Prime Directive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much I believe in the Prime Directive overall. It's, I understand the purpose of it, but it does get broken so frequently. And it seems like in almost every single case, everyone is forgiven for doing it. And I, the other thing is that, okay, this is what, a red directive, this whole mission here, which seems to come, you know, comes with it is this notion that rules are going to have to be broken because the mission is so important. So I guess there's an excuse for it there. I don't know if we're going to see Burnham face any consequences for this over the next final four episodes of this show. I do feel like, yes, if you'd asked some of those questions we were talking about earlier, you may not have had to break the Prime Directive in this one. But the most annoying thing about it for me is that we relied on the trope of we can't beam in there again.
Yeah.
Because the tritanium prevents the getting a lock on Tilly. They couldn't beam into the temple beforehand because of some protective shielding. And they've gone to that, well, what? Four times now this season?
Oh, that's such a Star Trek thing. I mean, anytime somebody in an emergency needs to get transported, I'm assuming the transport is either out or for some reason, some material is blocking it from happening. It's kind of like in Superman where suddenly everything is made out of lead because that's what he can't see through. And I'm like, no one builds that much stuff out of lead, even in a world where you've got a guy who can see through anything except lead.
Yeah. Yeah, but it made sense. And then it gave her the opportunity to give us the first half of the theme of balancing religious belief with technology when, you know, and all of this. So, okay, so fine. We have that here.
Did you want to see a Denoblian?
I did want to see a Denoblian in this episode, but we didn't see the Romulan and we didn't see the Terran. So I guess I wasn't too surprised that we did not see the Denoblian in this one, but what did you think?
I wanted to see it. This is the second time they've done that, right? The first clue, they're like, and they did it again. Like, oh, maybe we'll go to Betazoid. Maybe, you know, maybe we'll go to Denoblia. I would have loved to go to Denoblia. I have been fascinated since Phlox about that whole culture. You could have spent, hell, I'd watch a series on Denoblia. Mm-hmm. It sounds very interesting, but yeah. I don't know. I wanted to see a Denoblian. I was like, oh, I also kind of felt like, because they live a very long time. I was like, could he have actually lived? I'm never clear on the Denoblian time, how long they live.
Yeah. What do you think about the whistling aspect of this culture? That they were, over long distance, they would whistle to each other. And it was like, it's an entirely different language they would use compared to when they were face to face.
I think my answer to that question is they used it just enough. I didn't find it annoying. And when they said they did whistle speak, I was like, oh, I am not doing a whole episode of them whistling to each other. So I think it was cool. I think they used it just enough that it was cool. The idea that you used it over long distances, that this, I thought that was cool. But there is definitely a version of that episode where I would be, where we are discussing this and I am telling you how annoying the whistling is. It's just not this universe. So.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. I thought it was interesting. And I think the one part I liked about it is when we encountered it, when they were actually got down to the planet and Tilly and Michael were looking for the high summit, the tower, and they heard the it was a Rava whistling back to the one group that included the elder. It was sing-songy. As opposed mm-hmm. just to be, you know, that's the way it was getting translated for us, as opposed to, you know, we're lost. How do we get there? But it had melody to it. And so they actually put some thought into that, which I thought was pretty cool. They thought about it as opposed to just saying, oh, there's whistles. And
yeah.
And they translated the whistling as it was going, as opposed to Michael and Tilly getting that trick where they just say, oh, he said blah, blah, blah. But did she say blah, blah? You know, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was handled pretty well, but to your point, thank goodness they didn't do an entire episode of it. I mean, we got basically a minute's worth of it in the entire episode. And it was cool to see Michael get to use her xenoanthropology in this episode in order mm-hmm. to learn about this culture and figure it out before they went down there.
No, for sure. No, I really liked the way they handled it. And I liked, to your point, I liked that scene with Tilly and Burnham, where Burnham got to, you know, talk about all the different, you know, words for pain and dust, as opposed to there's no word for like class or status. I thought that was really interesting. And I thought that was, it's hard to set up an entire culture that you're going to do just an episode in without an exposition dump of some sort. And I thought this was a good way to do an exposition dump. So often it's like the characters walking to the transporter room, which of course you can't do in Discovery anymore. Talking about, you know, this culture and, oh, this culture is like this and this culture is like that. So I thought they did a good job having that scene in the Discovery universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, we got through most of the main plot points on here. There's a few things I did want to also bring up. One, you know, you and our teenager were all giggling over Michael announcing at the door, come. After that episode in Lower Decks, where they were all trying to figure out how they'd tell people enter their rooms while they were figuring, you know, they're looking, you know, for new quarters, and then, you know, come. It was like right out of that script almost.
Yes, it was very much. I don't think we had to pause the episode, but yes, there was definitely in our house several seconds worth of come.
If only Boimler was there to help out with that discussion. Second, the retinal tricorders
are cool.
This should have been a development in Star Trek a long time ago. Because, I mean, I feel like our smartphones get us most of the way to a tricorder anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to the future, it is going to be something that just, you know, a contact lens or something like that, even probably way beyond that. We're probably not thinking radical enough when it comes to that type of technology.
Yeah, no, for sure. I really liked the retinal tricorder. I really liked how it was just kind of introduced, and I liked how it was used. Like, it was used as a tool. I don't know that I was worried because I didn't give it enough thought, frankly. I was just like, ooh, cool, retinal tricorder. I did like how it didn't somehow save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It wasn't like, it wasn't treated as a cool tool that Q gives Bond. It was, here's the next step and here's something we're testing out. So here's a good chance for you to do that.
Yeah. But that was a neat piece of tech. And I like the way it just kind of like it would glow when they were using it, but then otherwise it would fade right back into the regular eye color and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's not the last we see of that. I hope they use that in additional episodes going forward And yeah, if they ever pick up this time period again for a future Star Trek show, make that a part of the whole thing that's going on. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like we've gotten through an awful lot of this episode and much faster than we usually do. But did you have anything else on this that you want to bring up?
Well, so what do you think is going to happen with Tilly in the Academy? Because I thought it was interesting that, you know, and I think this is going to play out a little bit more in the last three episodes. And I think Tilly is going to go back to the Academy. But I thought it was interesting that she has left for a mission but was also kind of, I don't know. I thought it was interesting on her in the Academy, and I'm probably overthinking it, but I was just like, you know, Tilly, you're not at the Academy right now. So the idea that people are leaving, maybe, you know, you're sort of modeling the go do something else behavior. I'm not blaming Tilly for this. I think I love a good Burnham Tilly episode, which is what this was. Those two work really well together, and I'm glad they got a chance to do that. But I was just, I don't know. I would like it to be resolved, I guess, a little faster.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a good excuse for Tilly. Again, this is a red directive, so she needs to be supporting the mission, and that's great. And Michael's depending on her for this one. But there are enough references over the course of this season about things going on at the Academy. She was talking about the one student that wants to leave the Academy and go work on a cargo vessel. And so she was kind of talking about how to deal with that. And they never resolved that one. She did bring up that example with the priest. What's his name? Ovaz with Reva. You know, you kind of have to let them go, you know, make their decisions and that type of a thing. And she also said something to Michael about, we could use you at the Academy. I think for Tilly, it's like, she's not getting a whole lot of support with this Starfleet Academy. I think it's largely up to her to figure out how to run this Academy. And I'm not saying that she isn't up to the task, but for someone who's in a lieutenant, I feel like she deserves more support than what she gets.
Actually, now that you say that, that brings up an interesting point, because I think one of the reasons why the whole sacrifice surprised Tilly is Tilly was reading that relationship wrong. That the dad was trying to keep his daughter with him and young and not letting her leave the nest. I think Tilly just misread that whole thing. One of my favorite things in that whole episode is Tilly when she goes, sacrifice? Like, what? Yeah.
Wait.
Exactly. But I think maybe she was just sort of reading the situation wrong and not, so it never occurred to her to ask any questions because she thought she knew what was happening. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, she was completely reading that wrong. And that may be actually what it is. There was an assumption issue with her and Michael this entire episode that they should not have necessarily been making. I think they thought they had this figured out when they got down there, and they weren't asking the right questions when it
came
down to this.
Because they thought they knew the answers.
Yeah. They kept finding themselves out of their depth. They did know how to get to the high summit. Then they revealed a bit of who they were by not understanding about what it was to get into the tower. And then they were revealing more about themselves with things like this. And they got away with it for so long until they couldn't. And then they had to break the prime directive.
Yeah.
And it was all said and done. Okay. They get the next clue out of the fifth tower, which is one of the ones that had failed on this. Mm-hmm. And it's pointing to Betazoid. Mm-hmm. Which is where the false clue was for the first clue. So, which kind of begs the question, if Maul and Locke had misread the first clue and gone to Betazoid, might they have actually found the next one already?
So that's why I'm assuming we are not going to go to Betazed, because I am assuming exactly to your point that had they gone. So one of two things will happen. We will realize that Mull and Locke have another clue that they've just never talked about that they got from Betazoid, or if the last clue is not going to be on Betazoid, to your point, because if Mull and Locke had gone there, they would have found it.
Yeah. So I'm interested to see what that is. And they, you know, and this episode ends with them getting called to do a black alert and a spore jump to wherever Mull and Locke are, because another ship, the USS Lockerer, Lorcher, I can't remember how it's pronounced. I wrote it down based off of the closed captioning, had been looking for them And mm-hmm. so, yeah, they're going to go there, and maybe that is Betazed or someplace else. So,
and I know it annoyed Burnham, but I thought Kovach made an excellent point as to why they were getting pulled off that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, your job is to find the tech. Your job is not to find Mullenlock. You seem to be combining those two things together. And so I'm going to uncombine them for you.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, last week, one of the questions we had about that episode was the two faces of the brain. I actually mm-hmm. read an interview with the writer of that episode, and we got an answer to that question.
Oh, good. Go.
Which is the first face of the brain is when they remove that helmet and we kind of saw that glowing presence.
Oh, so it's the glowy face. Yep.
That's a gelatinous. It's supposed to be a gelatinous thing. And then they harden it is the second face. And that was okay. The difference between the two faces. And it was, and hardening it is what the uncle was referring to about how that takes too much concentration and energy and it dulls your senses, et cetera, et cetera. And that could have been that's a whole cool. lot clearer in that episode.
That's cool, though. That's cool,
it is,
though.
It is cool, but it could have been clearer what they meant by the difference in the faces.
It could have been, and I would have loved that. I don't know how without sort of like, you are a Breen, but I'm going to tell you a Breen thing that you already know so that everyone else understands it. I'm sure they tried.
Yeah, I feel like a clever writer, though. I'm not saying that the writer wasn't clever, but I just feel like they thought that was too obvious to the viewer. And I really don't feel like it was. So
yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Well, we backtracked to another episode. So we've got this was episode 6. We got 4 left on this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be rapidly drawing to a close. We got, was it 2 more clues or are we on 1 more clue at this point? Let's see. We already had Janal Bix's clue. We had Velik's clue, and we had Carmen Cho's. And the other two sciences were Marina Derrick's, which was a Betazoid, and Creel was the Denobulan. So there's only 1 more clue to go in 4 episodes. So I'm assuming we're not getting to that next clue in the next episode, but maybe Mullenlock have it. So we'll find out.
Might be a Mullenlock episode, and then there needs to be a two-parter where the last part of that two-parter, whether it's actually a two-parter, they're just connected. I don't know. Is getting to the tech, and then there's a wrap-up episode.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, then that'll do it. Now conclude.
So, would you run it? Would you run the journey of the Mother Compeer?
Oh heck, no. No. No.
How quickly would you be disqualified?
Oh, I'd pull out my Gatorade and down it as soon as I took that disgusting whatever it was that made them thirsty. That's not why I run. So. Okay, well, with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this discussion of episode 6 of season 5 of Discovery. We'll be back soon with our discussion of episode 7. But before we go, Beth, you want to remind everybody where we can be found on social media?
I mean, yeah, definitely. We do have some social media presence. We are on Facebook and Instagram and X. On X, we're at Warp Trails. On Instagram and Facebook, we're at Warp Trails Pod. But mostly where we are, if you want to talk to us, it's the RetroZap Discord server. So there is a Warp Trails room where you can discuss Star Trek. And while you're there, you can join the rest of or check out some of the other rooms.
Indeed. And of course, our show is part of the RetroZap Podcast Network. Head over to RetroZap. You can find all of our back episodes. It's the easiest place to find all of our back episodes where we're talking about prior season Discovery, Strange New Worlds, Lower Decks, and Picard. But while you're there, you can find the other shows that are covering everything from video games, superheroes, Star Wars, and so much more. But that'll do it for this episode of Warp Trails. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Live long and prosper, and we'll talk to you next time.
A body in motion stays in motion.